Welcome, everyone, to the Southern Spoonful Podcast. We'll get to the show in just a moment. But first, I'd like to remind you to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at the Southern Spoonful Podcast for behind-the-scenes photos, stories, and the latest news with the show. If you like what you hear, be sure to like, follow, share, and leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. We'd greatly appreciate it. If you would be interested in sponsoring the show or placing an ad with us, then please contact us at thesouthernspoonfulpodcast@gmail.com. Enjoy the show, everyone. Unfortunately, down here, you know, we don't get a whole lot of snow at all.
No, you don't, but be happy for that. Deer hunting in 3-foot drifts is not fun. Although a deer slides easier on snow than it does on regular, you know.
Yeah, it makes the walk back to the vehicle a little bit more
easier. A lot easier, yeah. I remember riding a deer down a, I rode a deer down a hill because I finally got to a hill that was heading back towards our vehicle, and I got to just sit on it and ride it down to the bottom.
How many people can say that?
Not many, probably. Not many people probably want to say that.
Welcome, everyone, to the Southern Spoonful Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Hudson, and as always, thank you for listening. On today's episode, I had the pleasure and the privilege of interviewing one of Columbia, South Carolina's most influential chefs, Chef Christian Neamy. I recently joined Chef Neamy at one of his newest restaurants, Bourbon, in Columbia, South Carolina. We'll get to the rest of the interview in just a moment. But first, find you a spot at the supper table and prepare for a heaping helping from the Southern Spoonful Podcast. On today's episode, we'll be heading to South Carolina's capital city, Columbia. Columbia is known for the State Fair, the Carolina Gamecocks, and not to mention Hootie and the Blowfish. But that's not all the city has to offer. The capital city's food scene is steadily changing and ever evolving, with new restaurants springing to life with chefs ready to put their talent and flair on display. One of Columbia's accomplished chefs behind its food industry is Chef Christian Neamy. Chef Neamy has ushered in some of the city's more popular culinary establishments over the years. He is a master of his craft and a pioneer in his field. I caught up with Chef Neamy while he had a bit of downtime, and we had quite the chat. Let's dig in. And let's start with a few icebreakers.
All right.
So first of all, Duke's or Hellman's?
Boy, that's tough. I'm more of a blue plate guy.
Oh, okay. Never actually had blue plate myself, so I can't be a judge on
but
that.
But I would say after that, it would be Duke's. You don't find blue plate very many places, so I'd say Duke's. But I'll be honest with you, I usually make my own. So, not to sound like a chefy snob or anything, but...
Hey, nothing wrong with that. Cornbread or biscuits?
Oh, that's tough. I mean, really, it all depends on how you make your cornbread.
This is true.
But I'd have to say biscuits.
Okay. Let me just back to the cornbread. Do you put sugar in yours?
It depends. It really depends on what I'm going to have it with. I don't over sugar it if I want it the sweet style. But normally, like for chili and things like that, I don't put any in it.
Yeah. And we're the same way, you know, around our house, it's either cornbread without sugar or sweet bread is what we call it.
So. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. And vinegar, ketchup, or mustard-based barbecue sauce?
All of them.
All of them. You love them all?
I love them all. Even mixed together. Some of my favorite ones. Yeah, some of my favorite ones are have a vinegar base, but have some mustard in them and then have ketchup to kind of round out, but are more vinegar based. Some of those. And usually when I throw together something, that's usually what it ends up being.
And last but not least, Carolina or Clemson? I think I know the answer to this.
I don't give a shit about either of them, to be honest with you. I swear to God, I have always said, you know, okay, so I understand that the Gamecocks are a huge part of Columbia. I mean, they're a couple blocks away. The fanaticism around them is spectacular. But people don't understand how much they hurt business. Because when you pack 80-plus thousand people into a stadium on any given Saturday, that just yanks everybody out of the dining world, and right. So the restaurants are empty. So
never thought about it that way.
But. And everybody will say to me, like, well, but, you know, when other towns come to, you know, to Columbia to play, you know, you've got to be super busy Friday night. And it's like, yeah, but I only have so many seats, so I can only be so busy.
Right.
But I can be very slow on a Saturday night if they are playing a 7:30 game.
Absolutely.
And then a 3 o'clock game means that everybody tailgates until the game. And by the time the game is over, that first hangover's kicking in, and it separates the boys from the men, because 90% of people go straight home because they're ready to just go to bed. Yeah. I've always said the Greenville Gamecocks would sound way better than the Carolina Gamecocks. Let them put up with it.
Understood.
And they don't have a hockey team. They have a club team, which is really good, but they get no love.
Years ago, I actually went to a few
Inferno
games. Yeah. And I enjoyed it. You know, I'll be honest with you. I'm the type of person, it's probably about like golf. I'd rather play it than actually watch it.
Right.
And hockey is the same way. I'd rather be ringside to watch it versus actually trying to attempt to watch it on television.
I think you become a fan of hockey watching it live.
Yes.
Not by watching it on TV.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, if you would, Christian, tell our listeners where you're from and what was life like growing up for you there.
So, I'm from northern Minnesota. I'm from a small mining town called Chisholm, which at its peak in the probably 60s and 70s had a population of about close to 10,000. But over the years, since American mining has dwindled, it's dropped down to probably less than 5,000. However, it was probably the most idyllic American childhood you could imagine. I mean, it was it's a small town with a lake in it. You know, by the age of 5 years old, I was riding my bike, you know, probably a quarter mile away from my house. You know, and that just went up exponentially as I got older. You know, 6 years old, I was biking further away from home. You know, we were latchkey kids. You know, we got to do all the fun stuff. You know, we climbed trees and scun our knees, and, you know, I think about some of the places we explored as children. Had anything ever happened to us, they'd have had to follow the buzzards to find our corpses, because we were out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we would ride our bikes outside of town and we were in the wilderness, and we got to have adventures. And there was you hate to sound cliche, but it was the old be home for dinner at this time, and you can go right back out again, or call us if you're at a friend's house and let us know that you're there for dinner. But then when the street lights come on, you have to check in. It doesn't mean you have to come in, but you have to check in. Bicycles, dirt bikes, go-karts. I mean, my dad was a teacher. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. We didn't have a lot of money, but my dad was super handy, super mechanical, and I always had the coolest toys because of it. You know, and it's northern Minnesota, so you've got a short summer, you have a short fall, and then immediately you're into winter.
Right.
And winter lasts pretty much, you know, from November until April. You know, back then winters were a lot more mild. They weren't as kind of up and down as they are now. So he would clear a path. He always had a plow for his truck, so he would always clear an ice rink for us on the lake. And so I played hockey from sun up until sundown on the lake, and we would go sliding and snowmobiling and all that stuff. So yeah, I literally had about as good a childhood as anybody could have.
It sounds like it. Unfortunately, down here, you know, we don't get a whole lot of snow at all.
No, you don't. But be happy for that. Deer hunting in 3-foot drifts is not fun. Although a deer slides easier on snow than it does on regular you know.
Yeah, it makes the walk back to the vehicle a little bit more easy.
A lot easier. Yeah. I remember riding a deer down a hill because I got to finally got to a hill that was heading back towards our vehicle, and I got to just sit on it and ride it down to the bottom.
How many people can say that?
Not many, probably. Not many people probably want to say that.
So tell us now, you're from Minnesota. What actually brought you to South Carolina? Now, I understand that you were at one point in the Army. Is that correct?
Yeah. So my last station of duty was Fort Bragg, North Carolina, when I was still in the Army and was I was a Farsi translator. I had a best friend, a civilian best friend, who lived in Whiteville, North Carolina. And so every weekend I would go and stay with his family and him, and we would hang around and party and everything. And when I was getting out of the military, he was in the process of getting accepted to the MUSC pharmacy school in Charleston. So I went down there with him for his interview. And at one point he was like, "What are you going to do when you get out? What are you going to do in school?" And I was like, "Well, I'm really kind of looking at anesthesiology or being a heart surgeon, something like that. I want to get in the medical field." So he's like, "Well, why don't you just move down here with me and we can room together?" So I was like, "Well, that's perfect." So I started going to the College Charleston. Then I met my first wife, Melissa, and we got married. She, when she finished at the College Charleston, we transferred up to Minnesota because I switched over to architecture instead. And so while we were in Minnesota for the next 2 or 3 years, she worked at a private school and I went to school full time. And then the deal was, is that when I finished school, we would then go to wherever she wanted to go for graduate school. So she wanted to go to school at the University of South Carolina. So we moved down here and then got down here, and she just hit the ground running by heading into school. And then I was kind of standing around going, "Okay, what am I going to do now?" And that's how I ended up in the restaurant business kind of permanently, because all throughout college, what I found at the College of Charleston was the GI Bill didn't pay for shit. And I learned that within the first semester, and I was like, "Oh my God, how am I going to survive?" Like, I went out and got a job in a restaurant because everybody was telling me, "Well, the hours are flexible. You know, you can work your way up, you know, you can make decent money, still it won't interfere with your schooling." So I got a job at Ferrante's, which was in that kind of chapel that's down at the bottom of Market Street. Quickly worked my way up to being a waiter. I stayed a waiter throughout my entire college career because it was exactly like, you know, they said, the hours were flexible, you made great money. I looked at it as a craft that I could hone and get better at. So I learned a lot about cooking. I learned a lot about wines, spirits, service. Yeah, and so that's how I got in the restaurant business. And when I got here, I figured, well, I'll just stay in it for the time being until I figure out what I want to do. You know, the interesting thing about it was that until I got out of the military, I'd never really, really cooked a meal for myself. My mom and both of my grandmothers were fantastic cooks. When I got into the Army, contrary to what people say about Army food, at least at the time when I was in, and real Army people were cooking the food instead of government contractors, the food I had everywhere from basic training till I got out was really exceptional. I was fortunate being in military intelligence. It seemed like at every base that I went to, the mess hall for the military intelligence people was always better than the mess halls anywhere else. Like, it got to a point at Fort Bragg where you had to show your ID that you were actually in a military intelligence unit,
right,
to dine at our facility, because guys from all over the base were starting to figure out that the food was better there. But when I got to Charleston, I literally stood in my middle of my apartment one day and was like, "Shit, I've never, like, who's gonna feed me?" And so I jumped in my car and I drove down to the shopping center on Ashley Phosphate, and it had a Barnes & Noble and a Food Lion. And I went into Barnes & Noble and I bought a cookbook. I bought Pierre Frenny and Craig Claiborne's 60 Minute Gourmet. Then I went and sat in my car and I picked out a couple recipes, and I walked into the grocery store, bought the ingredients, went back to the apartment, made it, and was like, "Shit, this is easy." And this is my roommates started coming out of their rooms going, "Wow, what smells so good?" So from that moment on, I was kind of hooked on cooking too. So it worked out really well, you know, being a waiter, knowing a lot about food and questioning the chefs constantly about everything. Other than one of my grandmothers insisting on using instant mashed potatoes, which somehow she made, I've never been able to make them as well as she is. Both my grandmothers and my mother were not convenience food people.
Right.
Like, to us as kids, it was a treat to get a TV dinner. You know, we would beg and plead to get a TV dinner, not realizing at the time that, you know, the food they were making was way better.
Absolutely.
But it was the novelty of it, I guess, and knowing that all your friends are talking about how they had TV dinners, and like, why don't I get TV dinners? And then you realize after the fact that, well, because they suck.
I agree. I think we all went through that phase where we all just wanted something that we saw on television at one point or another, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you were talking about your grandmother's instant mashed potatoes like that. My grandmother would always make cornbread. She would always have a can of like Castleberry's beef stew. Not a little small can. Right. I'm talking about the huge can.
And family size.
Exactly. And of course, apparently she thought I was the family she was feeding because I would sit down and eat an entire can of this stuff. And to this day, like I said, she would make like individual little small, almost look like pancakes, cornbread.
Yeah.
Almost like Johnny cakes or hoe cakes.
Yeah, exactly.
And I cannot find anyone, bless my mom and my wife's heart, but to recreate that. And, you know, unfortunately with her passing, that's a meal I'll never have again.
You just gotta thin the batter out. Thin it out and then pour it into a hot cast iron.
That was one thing I never understood. They never had any kind of measuring spoons or anything.
No.
I'm like, what? We don't need that.
So it's funny you mention that. So my grandmother Rose, Grandma Rose wrote down her recipes for my aunts. My aunt Jane and Janice, they both love to cook. And they begged her, like in the later years of her life, to like, let's start writing these down because we want to be able to recreate these. And they found right away that what she wrote down and what she did were two completely different things. They're like, whoa, wait a second. What did you just put in there? That's not on the recipe. I forgot. Just the master teaching you everything you know, but not everything they know.
Exactly. And knowledge is power, and that's job security.
It is. She'll always be grandma.
Absolutely.
She'll never be replaced.
Yeah. I just want to say this before I forget about it, but I know you've been featured on a number of TV shows and a number of magazines and such, but I just want to say that in doing my research, my most favorite has been Off Menu.
Oh, yeah. You found those, eh?
I did.
Yeah.
And I saw the one where you made the Aperol Spritz.
Yeah.
And you taught people how to cook their own steak on the stove in the cast iron.
Yeah.
But I think the most memorable one was where I can't remember the name of the farm, but there was a little pig farm.
Oh, yeah.
Right outside of town here.
Yeah, Caw Caw Creek.
Yeah, and I just remember you just kept saying about the pig shit, pig shit. I was like, I just want to let you know I enjoyed them, and I kind of got a kick out of them. They were enjoyable.
Yeah, those are fun. Those are all on YouTube. They're not easy to find because there's some other shit on there that's like under Off Menu. But if you put in Christian MN, it'll usually take you to all
right.
of them.
So, with everything you've been through and you know, up to this point, up to where you are now, is there any point in time that if you could go back to and give yourself any kind of your younger self any advice, what would that advice be and at what point in time?
Don't open a restaurant in Lexington. It's like close to a $400,000 mistake. What's funny about it is out of all the restaurants, the only one that ever failed was a Mr. Friendly's that we did in Lexington. And it took until after it failed, and I was talking to a friend of mine from New York or Philadelphia, but he made the offhand comment, because it was the only restaurant I'd ever done where we looked at demographics, and we really kind of dove deep into it and tried to find out, like, you know, median incomes and households and all that stuff. It gives you a misrepresentation of what you're really looking
right.
at. And because at the time, right around 98, 99, when we did that restaurant in Lexington, Lexington was growing quickly. So it gave you the appearance that there was a lot of disposable income there. And then what you realized right away after we started to fail when you drove around Lexington was there was not necessarily a lot of disposable income there. Everybody had a new house because they were building like crazy up there. Everybody had two cars in the garage, and everybody had kids in school.
Right.
So not only were they poor on cash, mm-hmm. but they were poor on time because you're trying to manage a young family at that time, and going out to eat was not really high on the list.
Right.
It was what they wanted to do. They really couldn't. The interesting thing that he asked me was, well, did you do the grocery store test? And I was like, what does that mean? And he said, well, if you go to the local grocery stores in the area and they don't have the ingredients that you have on your menu. And before he even finished the sentence, it was like I got hit in the head with a baseball bat. I was like, oh my God. I'll never forget all the nights I would run out of the restaurant because we were out of something or somebody didn't deliver something. And I would run to the local grocery store in Lexington and look for balsamic vinegar, which nobody even knew what it was.
Right.
Decent bread was impossible. And there was just so many ingredients that were on our menu that you couldn't find at a local grocery store, which should have told us at the time that 20 plus years ago, Lexington wasn't eating those things.
Right.
I would just say, if I was to look back and give my younger self any advice, it would be two things. Do the grocery store test, obviously. But number two, early on in my career, I was pretty high strung. I was not probably the easiest person to work for. I thought I was, but I was quite a taskmaster and showed my disappointment. I've never been the screaming chef type, but just I showed my disappointment in my face. Like if you let me down, you knew it. And I know that's, instead of talking it out and telling people a little bit better communicating, I was not very good at that. So I worked way too much. So that first wife I told you about earlier, well, I would get home from work and she was already asleep, and I would get up and leave for work before she got up. So the day she told me she was leaving me, I literally said, I can't believe it took you this long. So when I got down here, the first thing that happened was I got a job at Garibaldi's as a bartender. I must have waited on somebody one night, and I got a call at work one night, and it was a guy on the phone saying, would you like to manage a restaurant? And I thought, well, you know, sure. I'm not doing anything with the architecture thing now. We're kind of in a mini recession, so... And nobody's hiring somebody that specializes in historic preservation, especially in Colombia at the time. I mean, Colombia was not known for preserving any architecture at that time. So I thought, well, what the hell? So it ended up being a job at Longhorn in the Vista. I was fortunate to go through their training system where you basically start as a dishwasher, and then you go through every position until you work your way through, all the way through back of house, and then all the way through the front of the house, from hosting and bussing tables to waiting tables to bartending, and then you start to manage. I did that and was one of the managers there, and then I got taken up to Charlotte one day by Bill Dukes, the owner of that one, and he took me to Blue Marlin that they were doing on East Boulevard in Charlotte. And it was still under construction, but they were close. The kitchen was starting to crank out dishes for practice and everything like that, and so we stayed up there, looked around, and then they made us a lot of the things that they were working on. And they said, so what do you think of it? And I said, I think it's a fantastic concept. You know, it's definitely got legs. I mean, this will do well. And they said, well, that's good, because you're going to be the opening general manager of the one in Columbia. So while they were under construction over there, I was still managing at Longhorn. And then from that moment on, I got to give Bill, you know, props, because he did all the stuff behind the scenes, like setting up the accounts for, you know, handling the construction and all that. But actual operations wise, he left me in full control of hiring the staff, training the staff, everything.
Right.
I mean, you know, he would just basically come in and check on me once a week, once or twice a week, you know, like everything going well. It wasn't like he never micromanaged me. He let me just kind of do it. So after a while, my floor manager, Harold, and the assistant kitchen manager, John Campagna, Harold just kept kind of poking me, going, we should do this on our own. We should go do this ourselves. We bought Mr. Friendly's, a little sandwich shop down in Five Points, and that was the beginning of it. I think that gets back to your question of what would I tell myself?
Right.
Take opportunities as they come to you, because you just don't know where they're going to go.
Absolutely.
You know?
I think that could be applied to most anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny. My grandfather, both my grandfathers fought in World War II. But my grandfather that was living at the time when I went into the army, because he was in a war, his piece of advice to me was don't volunteer for anything. Right. So I went into basic training with this don't volunteer for anything. And then I found out, I was like, if you don't volunteer for anything, you're going to be bored out of your mind. So I started to volunteer for everything. And now at first, those are the shit jobs. Now we need a volunteer. My hand would shoot up. They're like, okay, you're going to scrub the toilets. I'm like, I don't care. Like, so what? I'll scrub toilets. It's better than sitting around doing nothing.
Absolutely.
So I would scrub toilets. Next time, need a volunteer. Hand would shoot up. Okay, well, you've got to, you know, it was winter when I was at basic training. We have to shovel. You've got to shovel the stairs off. I'm like, I'm from Minnesota. This is nothing. I'll shovel stairs. By the end of basic training, they would say, we need a volunteer. Nimi, don't. Just literally point at me and go, don't. And so someone would raise their hand, and it would be one of those shit jobs. But then they would just come to me, and they'd go, hey, you want to do this? So I'm also kind of an artist, so I ended up doing, like, they would go off to do stupid shit, like pick up trash, and I would paint murals, you know, those gung-ho murals that you see in, you know, kill them all, like God, sort them out sort of shit. I would paint those on the walls of the barracks, and then at night, I would paint stuff on the front of the desk of the drill sergeant while I would give him relationship advice. So, you know, I just learned, like, you volunteer for everything, and the opportunities that open themselves up to you are, you know, that's what makes for a fun and exciting life.
Exactly. And that's something I've tried to convey to my kids over the years, is that shit jobs lead to bigger opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So all stepping stones.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I'll tell you what, in the food and beverage business, if you get a job at any chain restaurant and you stick it out and show them that you want to advance, you can move up so quickly because the attrition is so high that before you know it, you could start off as a dishwasher at a Longhorn, and within a couple of years, you'd be the general manager of the whole store.
Right.
But same with any fast food place. You know, you can move up very quickly in those companies. So, yeah, just don't be lazy and be eager to work.
Yeah, most of the time, you know, nobody really wants to sit back and actually take on those jobs. You know, nobody wants to take them on. Nobody wants to do anything. Well, who wants to do that?
Oh, they all want to own a restaurant, which I can just tell them, like, if you didn't want to do the shit jobs, then you don't want to own a restaurant. Because I'll tell you what, I don't know how many times on a Friday night, I had to be the one in the back with my arm all the way up to my shoulder, deep inside the grease trap, pulling a handful of straws out that was backing up the entire plumbing system. I don't know if you've ever smelled a grease trap. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it's spectacular.
You know, I used to drive a truck, and when they sent us out for training, this one particular place where they told us, they said, the one rule we had to follow, stay off the grass. And I said, okay. And I shut up about it. And everybody else was, why can't we walk on the grass? The point of it is that if you can't follow that one rule,
right?
Why does anybody want you driving their $60,000-$70,000 piece of equipment?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm like, did nobody else get this? So,
and it probably had nothing to do with the grass. It probably was just simply a test.
Yeah, because it wasn't the best grass.
Yeah, it's shitty grass. You still can't stay off of it. Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Get out of my truck.
Exactly. You have played a major role in Columbia's food scene. You've helped start events, organizations such as Slow Food Columbia, Soda City Farmers Market, the Great American Whiskey Fair, and the Farm to Table Event Company. Not to mention the list of restaurants that we've already named that you've helped open up as well and own. So is there anything you haven't done that you really wanted to?
So Farm to Table and some of the events, that's a partnership with my partner Vanessa.
Right.
And she's the one who started the Farm to Table Event Company, and that, you know, I couldn't wait to be a part of it. She, you know, she was doing it with a different chef at the time who couldn't really commit the time to it, and I finally got my turn to do a Farm to Table dinner and was just like, I want to do this all the time. So we just went from there and then ended up starting F2T Productions. The Great American Whiskey Fair has turned into like one of the premier whiskey shows in the entire nation, and you know, that was a that was one of those Mickey Rooney, Katharine Hepburn, let's put on a show moments.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were in construction here at Bourbon, and it was just like, all right, we aren't going to be done for another, I don't know, 6-7 months or whatever. Like, we got to do something.
Right.
So we started the Great American Whiskey Fair. And are there things I want to do? Oh, God, yeah. Like, there's a list of different restaurant concepts that I would love to do. I've got two in my head right now, and both are very location-specific or dependent. But I'd want to do that. I want to continue with the Charitable Plate and its mission. I think it helped a lot of people in the hospitality business during the pandemic. And what we like about it, I think what Vanessa and I envisioned with it, I think it's just really kind of just begun. Like, we don't go out and ask for any corporate sponsorships for it or anything like that. And it's a complete 100% pass through charity. Like, every dollar that comes in goes out, because we have jobs. Like, we get paid, I get paid at the restaurants, she gets paid through the catering company and the event company. So the Charitable Plate literally was like, let's have a charitable organization that helps hospitality people, and in any way that they need help, there's no costs involved with it. There's no overhead. You know, it's not like only 30 cents of every dollar is actually going to the end user. In this one, other than probably bank fees and stuff that normally, mm-hmm. and credit card fees that get taken out from events that we do, 100% of the money that comes in goes to the recipients. So expanding that, I think, over the next few years would be kind of top of my list, along with, like I said, I don't have a compulsion to do restaurants. I do restaurants as I see kind of fit. I think there's a misconception out there that I start restaurants and then I sell them off, and that's not really the case. In the case of like Mr. Friendly's and Solstice, that was simply a situation where the three partners, myself, Ricky, and Harold, I wanted to do Rosso, I wanted to do another restaurant, and they were okay with just having the two restaurants. And so we just sat down and had a gentleman's agreement. It's like, look, they were like, look, we don't want to hold you back, but we don't want to do another restaurant. I was like, yeah, and I don't want to force you guys to do another restaurant, but I'm not going to be happy unless I do. We basically, no money even, had to change hands. We swapped some stock around, and I took Gervais and Vine, they took those two. So that was that situation. So it's not like I built it up and then sold it off. Gervais and Vine was, I sold that because I had kind of reached a point of like, I'd had it for, 12 years, and it had kind of plateaued. Both creatively and financially, like, it was in a great position where whoever could buy it would make great money.
Mm-hmm.
And creatively, I kind of felt like I did everything that I could with it.
Nice.
And then Rosso was a completely different situation in that just I had a partner, a financial partner in that, who was in the process of retiring, and he was kind of cashing everything out to move. And it was just easier to sell it, because it was never as financially successful as we had hoped, so it wasn't like I could buy him out. So it was just easier to sell it and split the proceeds, which we ended up getting screwed on anyway, because the guy we sold it to ran it into the ground and never paid us. So there's another piece of advice I'd give my young self. Don't own or finance anything.
Understood. So now I understand that you're quite the world traveler. So what's your most favorite destination so far, and why?
Oh, that's tough. I'll put it this way. If I was told I only had a certain amount of time to live, I would drop everything and I would move to Greece for multiple reasons. Number one, all right, the Greeks don't know shit about running a country because they ran their economy into the ground. And, mm-hmm. and when you go there, you understand why.
Okay.
No one should be able to retire after 20 years with full pay. Okay. That's what they did. That's why they ran it into the ground.
Exactly.
So if you started your job at 18, this was an example I was given by our driver we had one day. His aunt started with the National Greek telephone company at the age of 18. She retired at 38. In the last 2 years of her being in there, she got all these, like, which they call ghost promotions. So your title changes, you don't leave your desk. Your title changes, you get an increase in pay, you get another increase in pay. You keep getting these titles in the last couple of years so that when you leave, you're making max. And then you get, and then you're 38, so you can go off to a completely another career if you'd like.
Right. So,
but with that being said, I would go to Greece in a heartbeat, because those people and that culture and that piece of land comes together to give you one of the most fun cultures you could ever want. I mean, the hospitality is at the core of these people, and they love to get together and eat and drink and sing and dance and talk, and it is just the most vibrant place I've ever been. We were there for 3 weeks, probably 3 or 4 weeks, and I didn't want to leave. And I've traveled to a lot of places, and you know, usually not as a tourist, more as a traveler, and you know, I like to get somewhere and settle in for quite a while and right. spend a lot of time there. But as much as I love, like, I did spent a month in Spain and I had a blast there, and spent a month in France, loved that place, and there's just a lot of countries that I really love and love to visit. But if I only had a year left to live, I'd spend that entire year drinking ouzo and eating, you know, fresh fish straight out of the Mediterranean on a daily basis with Greeks.
Who could go wrong with that?
You can't. I cannot emphasize it enough when people ask me where should I go. I'm like, go to Greece, hop around the islands, go into the local restaurants. As soon as you sit down, don't act like a tourist. And this is the case for every bit of travel. Don't act like a tourist. Don't sit down and ask for a Diet Coke and then speak really loud in English, but slow, loud and slowly. Order what the locals order. Sit down, get an ouzo, order like 3 or 4 little appetizers, and then start to look at the menu and just right. show them that you're there to enjoy yourself.
Absolutely. That, I mean, me and my wife, we love to travel and we love good food, and that just sounds like a great time. I mean, I've talked to people, you know, aside from you, that have ventured over there, and they just said everything's different. It's just a completely different experience.
It is.
And it's just a kickback atmosphere. Yes. People love it. And, you know, like you said, that's something I've tried to encourage my kids as well. You know, always try something new. You yeah. never know what you're going to like
yeah.
until you try it. And I see now why my parents always did that to me, because they're like, do you know what you're missing? I'm
right.
like, no, I, at this point, I don't care because yeah. I'm not eating that oyster, you know? So.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. That's good stuff. Good stuff. All right. So have you ever had do you have a trip, like a dream trip aside from Greece that
around the world,
just completely around the world?
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually had that planned a few years ago. I had garnered enough points on my credit card for travel, the one that I use that has the best travel benefits, and I actually had enough to go around the world, and it was going to take, I was planning on taking about 3 months to do it, and the plan was like from here to Iceland to Ireland down to... It, you know, when you talk to the companies who specialize in this, there's two major companies that specialize in around the world trips, and one is for more like students that are going to backpack and stuff, and one is more for people like me who have the money to do a little bit more. And one of the things that you find out is they have worked out a system where they know which hubs, which cities you can have at least 48-hour, up anywhere from 24 to 72-hour layovers. So it's you're basically passing through. It's not a separate ticket.
Right.
So like London's one of them. I think Paris. There's some others. Like you can fly into, and you have like 48 hours before you have to get on your next flight. So, but yeah, I had mapped it out completely. I ended up down in Vietnam, then it would have been Australia, New Zealand, or vice versa, and then Hawaii, and then the West Coast, and then back home. But yeah, so that's still high on my list of what I want to do. But another thing, you know, I'll be honest, I've sucked at exploring the U.S. Not gonna lie, there's just like a lot of places that I really kind of wish I, you know, that I want to go, and flights to those places are way cheaper than around the world.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And they speak the language.
True.
For the most part.
You know, that's something that me and my wife have always tried to do. You know, hey, well, let's go here. We've never been there. Or, you know, let's ride to Mississippi. And we're like, nah.
Yeah. This
is, I'm like, why do I want to spend the money to go to Mississippi on a riverboat gambling trip or something when I can fly somewhere, pay a little bit extra, and enjoy something I'll probably never do again.
Yeah.
So,
I agree. So what do you feel like? So what's your thoughts like right now on you know, if with the light at the end of the tunnel,
mm-hmm.
that we see now at the end of COVID? I mean, for me, the biggest thing is like I just foresee myself having that freedom to travel again.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the biggest, for me, the biggest benefit, because I just feel like there's a lot of shit, let's face it.
Right.
Like just being able to get together, having a dinner party with a lot of friends and not being worried about it. You know, going back out and socializing. But really, travel to me is like, that's the one thing. My wanderlust has just been, you know, crushed into a can, like, you know, those gag cans, you know, when you finally take the top off and it springs out. That's gonna be my, you know, that's my wanderlust.
And see, that was actually a good segue into my next question. But where's your first trip planned afterwards, after pandemic?
I'm really not sure yet. I know for sure, like, my girlfriend and the kids, we want to go up to Minnesota to visit my family. Mm-hmm. and I think it'd be cool for the kids to see kind of what it's like to live somewhere where you just have that freedom to do whatever you want, whenever you want.
Right.
Although, for, you know, like I said earlier, you know, with my hometown being down to like 4,000 people, it might not be quite as fun for them, but.
Right.
But yeah, we definitely want to do that. But as far as getting out of the country goes, boy, I don't know. I've got a former exchange student, Maria, from Bulgaria. She and her husband now have two daughters that I've never met, so I'd like to go to Bulgaria and see them. My friend Wendy and all the chefs in Paris that I'd like to go see. That list is long, buddy. List is long.
I can imagine so. You know, the last trip that me and my wife, well, actually the whole family actually took right before the pandemic hit, right when the door was just opening up, we actually went to Disney World last year. And the entire, you know, you go to Disney World and you forget about Facebook or you forget about Instagram and it completely vanishes.
Exactly.
And so the only time I'm using my phone is to take pictures get video or something like that, or to keep track of our schedule. So at the end of the week, we went from a Sunday to a Friday. And so Friday morning, we actually ended up coming back home and we stopped. We ate breakfast. I let the kids, because one thing was, you know, instead of waiting in line for all the characters, I'm like, let's just do a character breakfast and be done with it. We'll do it on the way out.
So, there you go.
So as we did that, we left. And on the way home, I'm not feeling so good. And then, oddly enough, when I get home that night and I get to look and I'm like, what is all this Corona? Corona? Why is everybody having beers at this point? You know? So I'm like, oh my gosh.
Oh my God.
And then they said it was a Chinese virus. I said, oh my goodness. And I'm like, there are several Chinese people at, I don't mean no harm, but at Disney World, several travelers from around the world, no matter where you're from, you know, they all come there.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
they were all stuck in airplanes together.
Yeah. And it was hard to imagine, but back then that was the time before masks.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, we were all, I couldn't tell you how many people I hugged up against. I don't know. So, and that was one thing that kind of put in the fear in my head. And then doctor was like, no, you're fine. I was like, okay, are you sure? Y'all don't have a test for this. Are you sure? You know, but anyway.
Did you ever get an antigen test then to see if you had had it?
No, I'll be honest. The only time I've been sick this entire time was actually in pretty much the entire month of November. Now, what scares me about that is the fact that my doctor could not actually tell me what it was that I had. And every time I'd go back, she says, "You definitely have something viral." And I says, "Okay, well, that's not good." And that's, you know, with the blood test, that's what she could tell me, that it was definitely viral. But she couldn't put her finger on what it was. And she said her son, her youngest, had actually had it as well. And so I'm wondering, like, what's going on here? So at the end of the month, it starts to really take a turn for the worst. I'm not coughing. I'm not having any trouble breathing. And at the end of it, I go to the emergency room because I was to the point where my food started to taste funny. And I said, "Oh, goodness. No, 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 no."
You're like, "I've got it. I've got it.
That's what it is, exactly. But I took 3 different types of tests throughout the month of November. And every one of them come back negative. And the doctor at the emergency room, you don't have COVID, but you do have pneumonia. And I was like, "Are you sure it's not COVID? Or was it COVID?" And he was like, "No, it's not." He said, and the way we can tell is, he said, "You have it in your right lung." He said, "If you did have it, it would be an exact mirror image in both lungs." I said, "Okay, well, that settles that, I guess, you know. So what do I need to do to get back at it, you know?" So, but anyway, a few days of rest and medicine, and I was good to go.
That's good.
I'm glad I caught something. You know, I'm not the type of person to normally get something like pneumonia. So I was like, you know, this isn't normal for me.
No.
And if I get anything, you know, my wife fusses at me all the time. "Why don't you take the flu shot?" I said, "Because I won't ever get a flu. So why would I?"
Yeah, I've gotten the flu shot now every year for the past, almost 20 years now, and I haven't had it.
Right.
So
I couldn't, I mean,
I'm like, it only takes a couple seconds.
Is it true?
And get it at the grocery store.
Right.
Like, I'm literally walking out. I let my pharmacist there know on the way in, and then on the way out, she's ready. I just stop. She pokes me. I walk out the door. I'm like, okay, it was as easy as that.
Yeah.
And I've never, and 20 years now, I haven't gotten it. Not like I got it before, but I know one time when I first moved to South Carolina, I had gotten the flu in one of the very first years. And then that was when I found out, oh, they have shots for this? I was like, duh. So, yeah. But no, I'm just looking forward to travel.
Absolutely. I'm to the restaurants opening back up, to just being, have that freedom. And I'm sick and tired of wearing a mask. I'll be honest with you. And
yeah, I'm not going to lie. How can you enjoy it?
I agree.
I do it all the time, but I don't like it.
No.
I hate it.
I agree.
Although I will say, like, I'm ready to poke the eyes out of anybody that goes, "Well, you know, they haven't even proven that they work." I'm like, well, if they don't work, then your doctor wouldn't, surgeons wouldn't wear them when they were doing surgery.
Right. I agree. Very true. I never even thought about it that way, but very true.
Right? Yeah, they just walk in chewing gum, like, "Oh, we'll take care of this."
I agree. And see what stinks about it. My current employer, you know, we have to wear it 24/7. I mean, around the clock, when as long as I'm inside a building, and
yeah,
I have to wear it. So, but yeah. I'm tired of it, especially with this beard, because it is killing. All right, so we were talking about your trips and your travels. Is there any one moment that throughout all your travels that really kind of stand out? Anything that, you know?
I think the wanderlust, that bug got planted. You know, I didn't, growing up, you know, the idea of travel was like, you know, driving to Minneapolis. You know, that was a big deal. So I didn't really get the travel bug until I was in the military. And when I was, you know, I got to travel extensively. But I would say that the aha moment was in Egypt. We were in Giza, which is like a, for lack of better words, a suburb of Cairo, and it's where the pyramids are. And I remember throwing open the curtains on the hotel room that we were staying at. We were doing a joint operation with the Egyptian military intelligence people, and we were staying at this Ramada in Giza, and I remember throwing open the curtains and seeing the pyramids. About, I don't know, they're huge. The thing that people don't understand is just how big they are. Because when you see photos of them, you don't look closely enough to see that if you look really, really closely at the bottom, you'll see people. But you don't notice that because they're so massive. But so what I thought, you know, I thought, oh, they're about a mile away. They had to be at least 5 miles away. But seeing them with the sun coming up in the morning and being right there and seeing the pyramids. And then later that day, that very same day, we had I had a sergeant in a unit that we were attached to out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, whose family still lived in Cairo. And it happened to be Ramadan, so he took me and I think one other guy in my unit with him to his family's place in downtown Cairo, to their apartment. This is a regular little two-bedroom apartment, but they had put on a Ramadan feast that they invited us to that was just absolutely unbelievable. The amount of food that these women cooked and how good it was, I mean, literally every flat surface throughout the entire living room area was covered in platters of food, you know. And I remember sitting on the floor, and I spoke Farsi, so I could understand a decent amount of Arabic, and I could speak very rudimentary Arabic. But I just remember sitting there, and at a moment, you kind of have that moment of reflection where everybody else is talking, and you kind of like retreat into yourself for a moment. And I remember sitting there going, this is what a life well lived looks like.
Right.
Traveling around, truly experiencing other cultures, not showing up, hitting the tourist sites, then getting back on the plane and leaving. Exploring and engaging with a culture in their, you know, at their, on their home turf, is really kind of the best education, the holistic education that I think a person could have.
That is awesome.
It was like that to me was like, that was the aha moment, that trip there, because I'd been to a few other places at that point with the military, but we were in and out, and you know, was in for a training mission or something like that, or you know, I specialize in a certain piece of equipment in military intelligence, and so I would get to go on these like trips where basically the Army gets used as a sales pitch for the military industrial complex, you know, whatever contractor is building this piece of equipment.
Right.
You know, you're their free sales rep. So you go to these other countries and you show them how to use the equipment. And you're like, oh, this is great. We can jam, we can intercept, we can do this, we can do that, you know. And then you walk away going, wait a second, I should get paid for that. This is a $200,000 piece of equipment that they're probably going to order 10 of.
Yeah, where's my commission?
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
All right. Well, since we're at Bourbon today, let's talk about this restaurant in particular. Could you please tell us where you drew inspiration for the food, the drinks, the theming of the establishment?
The building. Literally. So I got a call one day from Brett France with First Citizens, and he said, hey, everybody tells me you're the guy in town I should talk to. Will you come down and take a look at a building that we're renovating on Main Street? Now, mind you, up to this point, like Main Street in Columbia it was a real slow burn for Main Street. Back in 95 when we opened Mr. Friendly's and were successful kind of out of the gates, I think in 96 somebody called me and asked if I'd come and put a restaurant on Main Street, and I took a walk around downtown one night and was like, no way, you couldn't pay me. Literally couldn't pay me. So I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll come take a look at it. So it happens to be this building. So this building is the John Brennan building. Now, John Brennan started construction on this in 1869, and he ended up dying in 1870, and leaving the place to his wife and son. But it was just one of those situations where, after he walked me through the building, I had no intention whatsoever of doing Bourbon. So we look at the building, I walk out the door, I was like, hey, I'll think of some stuff for you, like who you could market this to. I sat in my car out front for a few minutes, backed out, started to drive around the block, and I just called him back, and I was like, hey, you still there? He's like, yeah. I said, I'm coming back. I literally pulled into the same parking spot. Remember, it was cold and raining. It was like February of 2013, maybe. And I walked back into this space because I knew that they weren't going to offer me the other space because he already said they were going to turn that into like a training center, which they changed their mind. But so I walked in here and he goes, what are you thinking? And I said, I think I'll take it. And he said, really? I said, yeah. He's like, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to open a whiskey bar with Cajun Creole food and I'm going to call it Bourbon. Now, see, I had already discussed with him on the tour of the building that, you know, I kind of have some notebooks where I've got ideas in and I kind of flesh them out as I go along. And they're ideas for restaurants, but this was not in that book, and never was. And he asked that same question. He's like, what is it that inspired you? And I was like, it's this building. Like I said, I just feel that in here. Like, I feel like this would be a great whiskey bar, you know, and we'll play on the fact that it's in a building that has a facade that reminds you of New Orleans. So I'll do Cajun Creole food because that was the favorite cuisine of my now ex-wife. And I was like, and she worked right across the street. So I was like, I'll build a restaurant that with a menu that she loves, and we'll call it Bourbon because it kind of ties both all that together. So yeah, that was how this came about. It was kind of funny too, because you'd be shocked at how many people said there was no way this would survive.
Wow.
And I was like, I don't get it. Like, everybody likes Cajun Creole food, and it's diverse as hell because, you know, you look at all the different nationalities that make up Creole food, and then you look at the bizarre culture of Acadia and what makes up their cuisine. Then you tie in the fact that it's also a hotbed for Vietnamese refugees that came over after the Vietnam War and added their spin to what goes on there. So, and then who doesn't love whiskey?
Absolutely.
Right? America.
Seems like a win-win.
Right? So, yeah, so we... It took us a little longer to get open than expected, but it always does. I just have come to realize that every project takes longer than you expect.
Right.
But when we opened up, we were busy from the get-go, and we've kind of honed in what we do over those first couple of years. And now we're expanding over into the space next to us. So the new space will be more of kind of... While the original side will remain full dining, cocktails and everything like that, that side will be more like light bites and cocktails and stuff. So
right.
For the majority, you know, like I would say 50-50, half the customers that come here are just coming in for cocktails and maybe a little bite to eat. Right. The other half is coming in for full dinner. That side will be able to handle that.
Right.
So, and because we go on a huge wait, and for the past, I don't know how many years, we've been open 7 years now, almost 7 years, you know, when we go on a wait, the bars around us benefit from it, which is fine with us. I mean, that was great, but now we'll have somewhere where we can have people wait if they want to come for a full dinner, or they just decide they want to stay over there and
right.
mix and match small plates, you know. So cool. And then we have the whole courtyard now too, which is a game changer for us.
Right. Cool.
That much outdoor space.
All right. So something I saw on you guys' website, the Bourbon Van.
Yeah, the Bourbon Van. Yeah, so the Bourbon Van was began life in a junkyard in Tennessee. It's a 68 Dodge A100 with 227 slant 6, 3 on the tree transmission. And the guy at the junkyard said, it will run. He says, I know that. It'll run. And I was like, well, that's all I need to hear. So I had somebody go and pick it up, brought it here, and... my buddy Eric down at Alpine Paint Body, he did all the body work on it, and sprayed it the matte black, and then I can't remember what it's called. I think it's Hodge Restorations up near 96. He mm-hmm. specializes in Mopars.
Okay.
So he took it and did all the. He made sure, like, we didn't do any like major modifications. He just made sure that the engine was gone through. He put on all new brakes, tightened up the steering and all that stuff. And it's got, and then Bev South put in a six tap system on the side of it. So I can do two beers, two wines, and two keg cocktails off the side. Mm-hmm. And like I tell people, if good handling, strong brakes, air conditioning, overall reliability, and comfort don't mean shit to you, then that's the vehicle for you. Because I won't let anybody else drive it.
But you.
Because I know all of its quirks.
Right.
I know which way it's going to go when you hit the brakes. So I know which way to counter steer. I know when it's going to start, when it's not going to start, when it doesn't start, what it needs in order to start. I know all the little, its little eccentricities. It's pretty, but it's, I would have rather had like a 78 Dodge Tradesman, you know, with a 318 in it, a little more reliable with power brakes and power steering and air conditioning.
Hey, all that stuff's overrated.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So that is available for catering, special events, all that stuff, right?
Yeah. So, you know, the original idea behind the bourbon van got shot down right away because the alcohol laws just don't, you just can't, just because you have your restaurant's logo on the side of it, you can't just pull up to some place and start selling alcohol. That's just, I know, right? Yeah. States' rights. So that's not one of them. So basically what it is we can use it for any sort of catering event. Like if you have a corporate event or a wedding or anything like that, we can drive it up, provide bartenders. We can provide you basically just have to purchase all of your alcohol from a, you know, somewhere like Greens or Morganelli's or Bottles. And then we will take it then, and we will then, for a fee, bring the van, mix your cocktails, serve your stuff.
Right.
So that's really kind of the only legal way to do it.
Okay. So how many bottles do you guys have here?
We're probably getting close to 500.
Okay.
Different labels, yeah. No, that's not what you see on the shelves. That's less than half.
Wow.
So the rest are in cabinets down the hallway. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think, I mean, just looking at it, you would assume that there was over 500 bottles up there.
Yeah.
But.
Well, there's multiples of some.
Right.
Just because they're popular and so we have backups on them. But there are, yeah, some of the rows have multiple labels.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not for everybody. It's kind of like a restaurant that has a deep wine cellar.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have to buy stuff when it's available.
Right.
So when limited edition bottles come out, you have to stock up on as many as you can if you want to have them on your list for, you know, a long time to come, which we did from the start. We poured pretty much all the profit that we made, we poured back into purchasing stock. So we now have things on our whiskey list that other places have been out of for 5 years and can't get any more of. So that's kind of how we differentiate ourselves from there. There aren't really many other whiskey bars in South Carolina.
Right.
I think there's a few that are trying to be, but you know, I think they realize right away that it takes a lot of capital to get a library this deep, and it takes time. It just takes a lot of time.
Absolutely.
You know, we're 7 years into it, and now we're up to 500. So. Right. You know, when we first opened, we probably had 150. Then it jumped up to 250. Then slowly, incrementally over the years, it grows.
And you know, just as, you know, better than anybody, the boom of the whiskey business,
yeah,
you know, over the past decade.
Yeah.
And even before that, it was booming. But it's just slowly ever changing, and it's on a steady pace. It's steadily inclining.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that's the difficult part, is that you have to determine
what stays and what goes.
Yeah. So there's, you know, every time you turn around, there's another label out.
Mm-hmm.
And we taste a lot of whiskey. you know, it's, we'll be the first to admit there's some labels that we have that honestly we don't think are that good.
Mm-hmm.
But people like them and ask for them, so
right.
That's fine. But I don't think the quality is there. They're younger places, you know. They didn't age what we call properly. You know, they used smaller barrels. They got the whiskey brown, but that is not the color of a whiskey is not indicative of what's you know what's actually going on right. In the liquid. So yeah, some things fall off the list. Some new things come on. Some of the new up and comers that are, you know, starting to come online now. So, you know, we're at 7 years. We've been open for 7 years. The whiskey boom started to happen. We were like at towards the beginning of it. So it probably started to happen probably a year or two before we opened. It started to slowly ramp up. We opened, it was starting to really kind of percolate at that point. So a lot of whiskey companies started. And for years, they kind of put out some real shit because
mm-hmm.
it was little barrel stuff, brown, still tasted like moonshine,
right?
You know. But now we're at seven. We've been open for 7 years, so a lot of these places have now been open and have been able to age their whiskeys to a minimum of 4 years, if not more. And so there are a lot of really good whiskeys coming on the market.
Oh, absolutely.
But there are still those players that are coming into it because they still see the potential in it that are still not that good.
Right.
So
just curious, do you guys do any barrel picks?
Yeah, we do barrel picks, but nah, we haven't, like, this past year screwed that all up. So so we were scheduled to do some barrel picks this year and we didn't. We're fortunate though, because, you know, J&F in West Columbia there, they do a lot of barrel picks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get a lot of their stuff, and they've got great palettes over there, so they pick some really good stuff, and they've got access to some things that, you know, most places don't. So, right. You know, they do their own barrels of Weller. So that's, you know, we're fortunate that we've got them. They kind of picked up the slack while we weren't doing it. And I'll tell you what, that's the other thing as far as, like, if you're a whiskey bar, that is a huge output of cash to buy a barrel. And it's gone up tremendously since, you know, years ago when we picked our first barrel.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's best to share a barrel with somebody. Yeah. If you can find some other places that'll share a barrel with you, that's the way to go. Like, if we've paired up with Morganelli's in the past, you know, like, we take half, they take half.
Okay. So, just curious, what's the most requested bottle that you may or may not have on your shelf?
Well, the most requested, but not necessarily the most purchased, would be Pappy, of course.
Yeah, because I figured.
That's reached a absolutely bizarre cult-like status.
I agree. And yeah. That's somebody who's never had it.
Yeah, when my mom, before she passed away, asked me about Pappy, I'm like, okay, now we know we've jumped the shark here, because, like, my mom should not know about Pappy, but she's asking me about it. So the whiskey snobs on the forums and everything will all talk shit about it, but that's because they can't get it, usually. Or it's the fact that it's become so overpriced on the secondary market where most of them get it. On the primary market, it's gone up quite a bit from before. It's gone up a lot from when we first bought it. But it's still... it's still one of the best weeded bourbons out there.
Okay.
I mean, you know, but it's kind of like wine. Like, having owned Gervain Vime and having been in the wine business for a while, it's kind of that same thing about, like, those high-end cult Cabernets and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Like, do I want a $250 bottle of Screaming Eagle Cabernet, or do I want five $50 bottles of, you know, Mountain Feeder?
Right.
You know,
I can,
you know, some of these wines are literally coming from almost the same vineyards on the same mountainside, you know, separated by a road, and kind of like in France where places are divvied off into this is Bordeaux and this isn't Bordeaux, but right across the street literally is a winery that can't call themselves Bordeaux. You're like, okay.
Exactly.
Then I'm going to pay $250 for this bottle or $40 for that bottle. I'll take the $40 bottle all day long.
Absolutely.
So, I love Pappy. I, you know, someone pours me a glass of Pappy, I'm a happy boy, but I don't revere it the way people do. And even Julian Van Winkle,
right.
You know, like, he'll be the first to tell you, like, I don't get it either. Like, he's like, we've been making the same whiskey, you know, we've been aging the same whiskey. I've been choosing whiskeys and aging whiskeys the same since the 70s. And now suddenly it's this weird cult-like thing.
I can't remember the author's name, so I'm probably not going to put this in there. But the book Pappy Land, mm-hmm. That my daughter actually purchased it for me here not too long ago, and they were actually talking about how much everything went for at like an auction.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, just maybe 4 or 5 bottles of Pappy plus like a sought after Glencairn or decanter. Sorry.
Yeah,
it was the decanter. And it was like I think it was like $175,000.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that was at auction.
Yeah, that's one of those auctions where people are.
Right. It went to charity. So.
Yeah.
But
like,
yeah.
We donate. Like, Pappy is one of the things that we've donated a few bottles to charities that we care a lot about over the years because we know that that's going to be something that they are going to get a lot of money for.
Right.
And there's a lot more of the 10-year on the market now than there was ever before. And that was, you know, they saw. Julian and his son Preston saw the wave early on, and so they started getting barrels down early on, so that around now, starting last year before last, the 10-year started to become a little bit more plentiful, but the demand still far outstrips the supply.
Speaking, if we go back to trips, that's a trip I've been wanting to take and been trying to talk my wife into going, but traveling the Kentucky Bourbon Trail.
Yeah. It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't live up to the hype?
Not a lot of the places.
Okay.
Like,
it's kind of disheartening, but...
It is, sorry, but...
My wife will thank you.
Yeah. My advice for the Kentucky... You know, to go to Kentucky, if you want to go and experience the best places that I've found... Like, Wild Turkey, I thought, was one of the better places. I mean, Jimmy sits at the... I mean, he probably doesn't anymore. I mean, but Jimmy would sit at the front door and greet everybody as they come in. And if you want to talk about walking in, and I mean, it'd be like going to Buckingham Palace and the Queen sitting at the front door.
Right.
You know, greeting people.
That's crazy.
Like, that's, you know... But a lot of the places, what they've done is they've built these, like, tasting rooms... educational experience places that just they fall flat on the it's a little too touristy.
Right.
Yeah, some of them were really, I mean, pretty downright disappointing, but I love it.
Like,
you know, go to Louisville. I can't remember the name of the old hotel that's downtown, but I highly recommend it. It's one of the grand old hotels.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's fantastic, and you're right downtown. And then you just drive out of town. It's like being in wine country. You just drive out of town in any direction, and you're going to hit some of the different distilleries.
Right.
The bigger they are, the more likely you'll get cattle card into a experience thing. The smaller they are, the more you're going to get a more hands-on experience.
I understand.
So, yeah. So just be prepared for that. I will say that Angel's Envy, which is right downtown...
Mm-hmm.
That's a really spectacular tour, and what they did with the building, just being from my architecture side, taking a building that probably in Columbia would have been torn down 50 years ago.
Right.
You know, they made a point of keeping that building up, and then finally when those guys came in and turned it into a distillery, they did a spectacular job.
Okay. So, now I know you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but is she head bartender Cat Hunter?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so she just actually... What was the award she was given? Was it like...
She was a South Carolina Restaurant Lodging Association Bartender of the Year. But that's just a... I'll tell you what. That's just a cherry on top of what she has accomplished as, you know, the head bartender here.
Right.
What a lot of people don't understand about Kat is that prior to coming here, Kat was more of a speed bartender. Like, she had worked at Art Bar for years, where she wasn't putting together, you know, intricate cocktails. So what she brought to bourbon was the speed, which was something that we were highly interested in making sure. In all of our research on cocktail bars across the nation that we went to, speed was something that we wanted to make sure was paramount. But along with it, when she came, she just dove head first into classic cocktails, the history of cocktails. She, like, every week an Amazon package shows up and it's got another, you know, vintage cocktail book that she's found at some, you know, bizarro little bookstore that sells their stuff online now. And she researches through them and understands, you know, is that kind of Rain Man sort of ability to look at a cocktail and just by looking at it, at the recipe, knowing whether it's a good cocktail or not.
Right.
You know, like, and the good thing about it too is that she has no ego about it. You know, like, and I think that's the best quality that any chef or, you know, bartender can have, is that you don't have any ego about the cocktails or whatever food you're making. It's that you're open to criticism and are open to working with other people to get it right. And that's what I like about her, is that she'll put a cocktail in front of me for my, like, if there's one thing that I can say that I have, like, one ability that I have a great palate.
Mm-hmm.
May not be able to do anything else, but I have a great palate.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, back in the wine days, like, even building the list at Mr. Friendly's and stuff like that, I would choose wines that 2 months later would end up being like the best picks in Wine Spectator and Wine Enthusiast and stuff like that, because I have a good palate. And it's the same with dishes and food, like balance. And it's definitely there for cocktails. Now, there are certain styles of cocktails I like better. You know, I like boozy cocktails, but I'm also, I don't know, I like tiki cocktails. I love crushable cocktails. What I like about Kat is that Kat understands that every cocktail needs feedback. And so we work together on all the cocktails. She'll put them in front of me, or I'll come to her with an idea and go, hey, how about something like this? And then she'll take it from there and she'll throw it together. And then we go back and forth. And I think that's why, like, a lot of the cocktails that we come up with here end up being really difficult to take off the menu, because so many people become huge fans of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so rotating our cocktails can sometimes be a little bit of a challenge, because people will come in and they're like, oh, that cocktail that you had on here.
Yeah. Okay.
So she's special.
Yeah, I could tell, you know, just reading about her, and I can't even remember where it was. I was actually reading, because I was actually doing research for the show, and I come across this article, and, you know, it was talking about how she had just recently won the award, and then someone had dove into a little bit deeper that they actually went back and watched footage of her over a cocktail party she was overseeing. That was you.
That was me. So that was New Year's Eve. So New Year's Eve, we do a private ticketed event, because mm-hmm. we can only fill so many seats in here.
Right.
And it includes all your cocktails and food and everything. So, but we watched on film her at the service well, and I can't remember what it was, like 40-something, 45?
Yeah, I want to tell you it was 45, because I actually had it wrote down. It's 45.
45 cocktails in an hour. So that was like a little over a minute each.
Right.
And these are complicated cocktails.
Right.
So she's usually doing two of them at once.
Wow.
So it's, it's impressive.
That is. Yeah. You know, I've been to places sometime, and I never even got served. So,
yeah.
I mean, that is impressive, I promise you.
Yeah.
And that was her, like you said, she's making craft cocktails. And so these, like you said, take a little bit more time than a regular.
Well,
You know, yeah.
Well, I mean, they're just cocktails.
Right.
You know, the word craft gets thrown around a lot.
I got you.
But they're just cocktails. And some cocktails have what we call in the business more touches.
Right.
So that means your hand has to reach for something else. So, you know, you're talking about some cocktails are 2-3 touch cocktail, mm-hmm. and some are 7-8-9 touch. So the one thing, it's like food too. It's like any dish. Like, I have to tell the young, the rookie bartenders that are, you know, want to be mixologists and, you know, come up with great cocktails, that more isn't always better.
Right.
You know, and like Anthony Bourdain said in one of his episodes, he said, I always have to ask myself, is the whiskey cocktail going to be better than just a glass of whiskey? Hmm. So you have to make sure that it is.
Right. Very true.
And that's not easy.
No.
Because a lot of whiskeys are just damn good by themselves.
I agree wholeheartedly.
So,
yeah.
So it's got to be.
You know, I've done that. You know, I've got a slowly but surely growing collection of bourbon and whiskeys at the house myself. And then, you know, I'll find, you know, oh, I add this, or I'll make an old fashioned or whatever. And then the next thing you know, I'm like, I just ruined it.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So, other than travel, how, first of all, do you get any downtime? And second of all,
yeah, I'm able to. I mean, you know, the good thing about being an owner is that you kind of can, you dictate your own schedule,
right?
You know, how much you work, how little you work. So, I set aside time for travel, and I usually try to set it up at times when it's kind of, we don't really have a slower time of year at the restaurant, but I just try to set it up so that they know well in advance that I'm going to be gone. And you know, I'm fortunate that I have people that work with us. They don't need me around. They don't need me around.
That's fortunate.
I'm always available via email, or, you know, nowadays WhatsApp, a text, whatever.
Right.
So it's not that difficult to get in touch with me, FaceTime me, whatever. It's, you know, I may not be able to put hands on it, but I can give them the advice they need or the right information they need. So I can do that from anywhere in the world.
Yeah. But for the most part, everything's pretty much self-sustaining.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What's the best way our listeners can keep track of what you and your restaurants kind of stay up to date with the latest and greatest news?
I would say really the best place is to honestly is our social media. So whether it be our Facebook page, our Instagram page. I don't really do Twitter anymore. I kind of dropped that. At just too many haters on there. Like, just too many people just barking at each other. I was like, that's not a place to market.
Right.
So basically Instagram, Facebook. Yeah.
And of course you have the website, bourboncolombia.com.
Yeah, bourboncolombia.com and blackroosterSC.com.
Gotcha.
F2TProductions.com and honeyrivercatering.com. All those. GreatAmericanWhiskeyFair.com.
Speaking of which, that one's in its 7th year, correct?
Since we had to skip last year, it'll be its 8th year. It would have been its 9th year, but we lost a year.
Right. That one don't count.
Doesn't count.
Everybody gets a mulligan.
Exactly. So. Yep. Yeah, so when we have our 10-year anniversary t-shirt, it's going to say 2013 to 2024.
It's like the 13th floor. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah. Where he's going to, like, that math doesn't work. It kind of does.
It does if you were there.
Yeah, exactly. And if you weren't, I don't know where the hell you were.
Exactly. So, Chef, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to sit down with me today. And just, you know, I really do appreciate the opportunity.
Of course,
and it's been
you.
A pleasure. And I've got to stop this because we're actually running over an hour and a half at this point.
Oops.
But
sorry, folks.
No. In all seriousness, thank you so much. It has been a pleasure, Christian. Thank
Likewise.
You.
Likewise. Appreciate
right.
it.
Thanks.
All right. Take care.
So the next time you're in the capital city, do yourself a favor and swing by Bourbon at 1214 Main Street, Columbia, South Carolina, to say hello to Chef Christian Nemi and to grab a glass of your favorite spirit. They are currently open Tuesday through Saturday, 4:30 to midnight, and the new Whiskey Lounge is officially open. Head over to bourboncolombia.com to see all they have to offer. Now it's time to push in our chairs, put away the dishes and the silverware. And remember, there'll always be a spot here at our supper table for each and every one of you. Until next time, I'm Jeremy Hudson, and I've been your host. Take care, everyone.